Hi everyone, welcome to North and South Pods. This is Tim. This is going to be a history community, local history podcast with someone I've known for a quarter of a century, Colin McCormack. And Colin is someone I used to work with as a teacher, and he's a man of many talents, but he's also edited a book where Katie Amory and other people have written for the book. And Colin, you and Katie have written for the book as well. And it's a book called Transatlantic Slavery, Impact and Legacy, Case Study of Liverpool. And I'll share details of that in the notes. So, Colin, how are you? Do you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, thanks for having us, Tim. Colin McCormack, yeah, long time friend and colleague of yours.
You're currently training trainee
First,
teachers, aren't you?
currently in ITT,
IT,
working
initial
for,
teacher training.
got about 50 trainees working nationally as a subject development lead.
Good stuff. Bringing the next generation through, people like ourselves. And
Hopefully.
where did this book come from then? Because I know you're into a lot of history, but what got you into this particular topic to do with Liverpool and slavery?
The catalyst for it really was after the Colston statue fell in
And that was in
Bristol.
Bristol, wasn't it, during the Black Lives Matter riot and protests?
The 2020 Black Lives Matter protest. There was a bigger call and more of an urgency to write, to give a more honest appraisal of the nation's history and to tell a more nuanced and complex story. Narrative around something, empire and slavery, that had been, I would say, hidden largely from our curriculums. So after they wrote theirs, the Bristol teachers, as a head of history in Liverpool, I thought, when I was asked at a history conference, look, the baton's being passed to you, I thought it was a bit remiss of us local educators not to do something because, and I don't mean this in a boastful way, when you think about our ports connected to slavery, then Liverpool supersedes them all, really, if regards to this land, transatlantic slave trade. So, yeah, I felt myself and Katie get a few teachers together to curate better resources, ultimately a book for our, for our teachers and our local communities.
And it's aimed at not just people who are interested in local history, but also, it might be something that schools look at as well to use as a resource within schools for history departments. And is it available now? Is it available to buy
No,
now?
not till May. Not till
May.
May.
So May 25, it'll be available. And I'll share some notes when the time comes. Now, when the Colston statue came down, Colston was a big slave trader in Bristol. And apparently, when that statue was put up a century ago, it was controversial then. And obviously, the statue was taken down. It was thrown into the water at Bristol by Black Lives Matter protesters after the terrible murder of George Floyd in the United States, which you had to watch really to appreciate what happened there. And it led to these issues around the world, not just in the United States, also a backlash against that with all this culture war stuff. But apparently, the Colston
Absolutely.
statue is now in a museum. It's away from direct public glare, so you can still go and look at it, etc. But I think during the I think it was 2007 or 8 Liverpool Capital of Culture, there was a bit of controversy over whether we should talk about Liverpool's history with regards to slavery at the time. Now, oh, we don't want to highlight the negatives, as it were. But what's your view on that in terms of, I don't view our history of slavery in Liverpool, my city, as something that should be buried. I think it's just something that we should be upfront about. What are your opinions on that?
Well, that's a great question because, it's, the built environment is there for everybody to see. So the remnants of slavery, the slave economy, you're literally staring you in the face. So there's 150 street names with links to slavery in our city. And my opinion is, I agree with Sathnam Sangera, who says, if we understand this history, it brings us closer together. It shows us how the growth of Liverpool as a town and later the city, it grew symbiotically with the slave trade and the slave economy. So I think a better understanding of that and our migratory past, why people moved to the port, why we've got such a diverse population, it can only we got to do something to counter the culture wars, like you said, which are raging at the minute. And I've experienced them myself for curating this book, co-curating it. But my opinion is this book is a necessary one. And that's a reason why I've done it, to say to people, look, the past, as David Olushoga says, history doesn't care about our feelings. So the past, it is what it is, and we can't just celebrate the nation's past, like, oh, we beat the Nazis, or let's learn about Henry VIII and his six wives, which predominantly covers a lot of school curriculums. So, yeah, I just think, yeah, it was time, like Bristol, for an honest appraisal of our city's past.
Yeah, and I think that I don't know what the stats are. Is it something like for every seven slave ships that left the UK to go and pick up slaves, three came from Liverpool? So it's a
Well,
ridiculous statistic like that, isn't it?
if we're going to talk about the slave trade itself, and people will, which is quite reductive in a way, but because you need to move beyond the Atlantic frame and look at the multiplier effect and how, that money seeped right across the nation, not just in the ports. But if we're going to focus on Liverpool, Liverpool was late to get
The
to the
table.
trades, to the, yeah, because London and Bristol in the first, say, 40 years of the 1700s, more ships were clearing out of them ports than Liverpool. But with very rapidly, Liverpool merchants got a grip of the trade. And by the end of the 18th century, in the 1790s, Liverpool vessels contributed to over 80%.
By the time they got going, it was 80%.
80% by the time it ended in 1807. And another startling fact is, the British enslaved around 3 million Africans. 1.5 million of them left on a Liverpool ship. So it really was the capital of the slave trade. And the profits accrued from that ended up funding many of our local, the built environment, but institutions, banking institutions, insurance, etc., etc. So people on this side of the world certainly benefited from that free labor and that exploitation of enslaved people.
That's right. And it wasn't always, it's like anything with empire, you had a lot of poverty in Britain while we were basically running one quarter of the world. The profits only go into certain sectors. And Liverpool was very much a tale. It was called like a two cities, wasn't it? You had the very rich, the very poor. And the wealth that went into the higher echelons and the institutions and the buildings, etc., were, didn't necessarily trickle down to the average Liverpoolian. And I think that's interesting because you can see a lot of parallels with that, with like, a nation like the United States, where it's powerful economy, yet 60% are living paycheck to paycheck. It's very much a modern phenomenon as well, where great wealth comes in and goes into certain sectors. But you walk around Liverpool, it's got more listed buildings than anywhere outside London, I think, in the UK. And that's a legacy of the cotton trade, the slave trade.
They're all intertwined, you see. People say, well, the slave trade finished in 1807, but slavery grew after 1807 because the British Empire grew. But slavery wasn't abolished until, the 1830s. But that enslaved produced goods continued to enrich the city. I mean, the Liverpool cotton laws are still in existence today. They say Manchester's cottonopolis, but Liverpool can certainly not lay claim to it, so to speak, because none of this is anything to brag about. But it's the two cities are certainly got a lot in common, shall we say.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that the idea of the trade, that the ships leave the UK and Liverpool with lots of goods that are sold in Africa, the slaves go over to the Americas and then more goods come back. It was very, very profitable in so many different ways. Now, we've seen a lot recently with things like the National Trust, a lot of people getting upset over like a blue plaque saying, by the way, this house. A lot of the money came from slavery. And a lot of people have always said, oh, you know what, people on the left and progressives, you know, they're all snowflakes, etc. But the kind of thin-skinned nature of people on the right just to talk about slavery and acknowledge it and go, surely someone could go to a mansion and go, oh, by the way, this person did make money from the slave trade, as if that somehow undermines the whole experience. It's a strange one, isn't it?
Yeah, and I mean, throughout this project, I've become friends with Corinne Fowler, who did the inquiry into the National Trust and the culture wars. She really felt the force, you know, a lightning rod, a white lash, I would argue, because many people see the country house as quintessentially English, where, you know, you get your scones and your tea and your cakes. But when you peel back the layers, say, of the Chippendale furniture, land enclosure, you know, land was bought with profits from empire and slavery. Country homes were enriched with, you know, tapestries with, like I said, this furniture, so mahogany. From, you know, a lot of Jamaican forests where, you know, deforestation took place in, like, Jamaica, you know, Brazil, Barbados, etc., and end up, you know, back in these stately homes. But because someone, and that's what we've done in the book. We've done a chapter called Beyond the Metropole, because I was keen for this book not to just be Liverpool centric. So I got Caitlin Palmer, a young teacher from Yorkshire, who knew a little bit about Harewood House. I don't know if you've heard of that, and the Lascelles family. So we did some case studies about how slavery seeped beyond the metropole, and it's on everybody's doorstep. And another, you know, some interesting facts are, even in the slave trade, you know, there were investors from every region of the country. And that's been research done by Nick Radbourne. And there was over 10,000 of them. And then when we look at the slavery compensation database, so no enslaved people were compensated. You do know that in 2015, the Treasury put out a tweet, didn't it? Do you remember? Well, UCL, I've done a database of where the money went, and it was right across the nation. So this is a national, international story right across the empire.
I mean, that thing, we literally only finished paying the compensation to the people who lost slaves, etc., in 2015. A bit like, you know, like World War One, or we finished paying for that in the early
Right,
noughties, I
yeah.
think, to the Americas. But it is a staggering fact, particularly when people talk about like compensation to countries affected by slavery, whether there could be some
Yeah.
kind of like payments made, etc. And then they don't never mention the fact that that was ongoing anyway, the
Yeah.
compensation for what happened in the past.
People don't want to come to the terms with the legacies of this. So this systemic racism that we see in society today, and many of these inequalities, you know, race as a construct comes from transatlantic slavery. You know. I mean, you know, I don't profess to have suffered racism. Me and you both be classed as, you know, white middle class, because of our occupation. People might laugh at that listening to me and you talk right now. Writing this book, I was well aware that of how visceral and how, you know, deeply harmful this has been to society, to the black community and the black community of Liverpool. So obviously we wanted to listen to what they had to say, and involve them in, like, Katie Amory did the last chapter really good on their legacies. So, and more about memorization, etc. So, yeah, that's what I'm saying. This story still reverberates to this day.
Yeah, absolutely. It's quite good as well. I've done a few history tours around. There was a guy called Eric who used to do slavery tours around the city. And there's literally architecture banks where you've got like slaves depicted on the wooden
Yeah.
stone, sorry, on the stone carved outside the buildings. And you could walk past these without noticing them. And he took me to places where I'd never seen before. When he heard I was a history teacher, this is about 20 years ago, he said, I'll take you up, show you a little bit more. Because Liverpool was quite involved with the Confederacy during the
Well,
American
yeah,
Civil
there's a
War.
chapter on that. Yeah, a whole chapter on that. And all the chapters are inquiry based, so back to some teacher talk, you'll know what I mean, and disciplinary focus. So they've either got a causation, a change in continuity element. The question I asked there, I did that chapter, was, Liverpool were they on the wrong side of history, because it was said that more Confederate flags flew in Liverpool during the Civil War than in Richmond, Virginia. Which was so Liverpool was the de facto capital of the South. We raised the Navy, we funded, the Confederate war effort. And yeah, obviously, the city, the merchants of this city had a lot to lose from that. So many of the powerful people in this, in our city, were in favor of it. But like everything else, there were people who were pro-union. So that's how it kind of played out in the city.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that how much protest there was against the slave trade as well, nationally. Also, throughout the north of England and in Liverpool, there were many people concerned about it. And although there were like powerful interests and a lot of people had shares in slavery and slave ships when it was going, there's like little pubs like the Liver and South Road, which was considered like the base of the Confederacy. And they had actually
Yeah.
had a. Did they have an embassy in Liverpool as well, the South, during the
Yeah,
war?
they say, the first kind of embassy type facing John Lewis. You can still see, if you look up, which we often don't, we walk around town, don't we? Trying to get to the next coffee shop or whatever. If you do take a look at your built environment, then you can really see how this city, through Georgian and Victorian immersion of slavery, the slave economy. It's there, but like I said, it needs telling, and it needs telling in an adult way, not in a kind of like, you hate Britain for writing this book. You're saying bad things about our city. You don't love this nation. We need to be quite grown up about it and tell the truth about our past.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't think it's anything to be ashamed of. It's just something that needs to be acknowledged. Like, yeah, this happened. Let's
Absolutely,
learn
yeah.
lessons from it, you know.
I don't believe in tearing statues down, or I think more blue plaques would be informative. So Bold Street, for example, Jonas Bold, but culture wars rage around this, and I think my book's got about 6 years, because if reform get in, they're gonna see a book like mine as hating the nation. You hate Britain, because they want a national. Gove wanted a national story, didn't he? Our national story is complex, and that's like Churchill, the great wartime leader, but also, there's genocidal famine. There's all kinds of different things attached to him, and that's the truth. But some people only want to hear one side of these things.
It's a bit like the debate over empire, like you get people like Niall Ferguson writing books saying the empire was like generally beneficial, and you get
Like,
pushed
gave them
back.
a civil service, and we built railways.
Yeah,
But
railways
there's
in India
something.
is the big one. And yet all of those people, if you say to them, what do you think of the EU as a something we opted into when it's about economic development and stuff, the same people who would advocate that, like say Boris Johnson, how great the empire was, would be like probably pro-Brexit. But again, the culture war is just permeating everything to the point where like I do worry about even the ability to teach these things in the future.
Absolutely. That's because of algorithms, social media, etc. And obviously Elon's got a grip of Twitter now, hasn't he? And I think, speaking to the kids, we know, don't we, when we explore some deeper thinking, they are picking up a lot of misinformation and a lot of misconceptions. That so it's even more important for us to do what we do and
You get a lot about
correct.
free speech as well, like about, oh, people have the right to free speech and go, yeah, but doesn't mean that you just flood the zone with dis and misinformation that's deliberately trying to fool people. And I think that like things have moved so much in the last 20 years since I started teaching, where it's almost like A lot of people want to just bury certain things. And it's terrible because it's just like, people just need to know the truth. You can form balanced opinions. As you said, don't want to see statues turned down. Let's have tear down. Let's have a blue plaque explaining the
You know,
situation. You know what I mean?
I think, you know, we're teachers, we know that. I find when I have this debate in the pub, one guy was banging the table at me saying, there's a lot of what about today I get from this. What about the Irish? Just, what about the kids going down chimneys? What about the white working class? What about, the Irish slaves? You get a lot of it's quite, kickback. Like I said, that'd be earlier, a white lash. But I think the kids are up for this debate. I think children are that than some sections of our society.
A lot of the stuff I see adults putting on, even something like very powerful adults in the world, if a kid said something like that in the classroom or you knew of an adult you were associated with day to day like that, you go, something wrong with that person. And yet it seems to be like normalized now that like people high up can say these things for culture war reasons. But the book then is it's a series of sections. I've seen a lot of great history books which are edited with a theme. You've obviously got an inquiry, lots of different people covering different aspects. What was the most surprising thing that you learned, or what might a reader think, oh, I didn't know that, like the most unusual chapter?
Well, so some surprising things, like, so the Royal Africa Company, that so basically the royal family, that they had a monopoly on it up until the end of the 1600s, and they enslaved they were an entity that enslaved more people than anyone else, than any other entity. And then merchants in London, like the founder of the penny post, so the postal service, they lobbied Parliament for the ending of that monopoly, and then merchants across the country got involved in. So it's kind of the first case of leveling up, which we hear so much about. A thing that really took me back when we first started to put this together was like, wow, this is so big. Where do you start? Where do you end? And then, I knew a little bit about Liverpool's history, but most people in the city don't know that in 1650 we only had 1,000 people approximately. 150 years later, we're probably the second biggest town outside of London. And then in the 1880s, Liverpool had more millionaires than anywhere else in the country. And we were always, so we they have this idea that Liverpool is, a kind of traditionally left-wing, impoverished part of the nation. But the truth is, that's only a recent phenomenon, really, from like the 70s on. We were very like loyalist Tory empire, an empire city.
Yeah, that's interesting. It was one of the last cities to get a Labour MP because of the religious divisions as well.
Yes,
And as you
the
say,
settlement.
like the franchise has only been around for 100 years anyway, where the average
Yeah.
person even had any input as much as that's worth. But it's interesting what you said about Liverpool's population, because I believe like half the population was killed in the English Civil War when Prince Rupert and the was fighting on Everton Hill and attacking the parliamentarians. It switched hands. But it literally went from a small town to this huge city on the back of
Yeah, I
transatlantic
mean,
slavery.
in 1930, so by 1931, we had, we're approaching 1 million, but by 1981, we'd gone back down to the half a million, and it's still half a million today, roundabout. So, as you see, the growth of the empire and the growth of Liverpool, like I said, there's a symbiotic relationship there. And as you see, the decline of the British Empire post World War II, Liverpool, as you can see, struggled as everybody knows, about the managed decline in the 1980s. So that's not an accident that the two things coincide.
Interestingly, I think like quite prominent people in the Conservative cabinet at the time literally said, let Liverpool go into terminal decline and people will just go elsewhere. And it was after the Toxteth riots
Yeah, well,
that
that, yeah.
someone like Michael
Katie did.
Haseltine said, let's go and
Yeah.
take money up there and reinvent Liverpool, you know what I mean?
Katie interviewed Michael Heseltine, and then her school, West, that she worked in, that she did like a co-production with the drama department. And I've been taking it around the city, really. It's really powerful where the kids have, the Toxteth uprising, and actually went to Ezzeltine's house. So she mentions that in her legacy chapter as well. So I think that's
That's
quite good.
interesting, and I mean, people like him now seem like the modern equivalent to Che Guevara compared to what we've been
Oh, we've got
saved up
now.
now. But Liverpool was in decline by the 80s, and you look at Boys from the Black stuff, that kind of it just goes to show how patchy the money coming in to Liverpool was, where it went, that it isn't, shared equally, which we see in a lot of modern nations. Probably one of the biggest problems in the world is inequality, which leads to things like anti-politics, populism, aggressive stuff, which of course fuels the culture wars. It's all kind of interlinked, isn't it? But I mean, you go to Liverpool today, I mean, since the capital of culture and that, you're going to Liverpool, I'm hearing accents from all over the world. It's very much a global city these days, isn't
Always
it?
have been. This is the thing. I mean, we talk about Abel in the book, one of Liverpool's earliest black residents. Because there's lots, if you go look at the burial records and the baptismal records of like St. Nicholas Church and other churches, you're gonna see faces black and brown. And we are like the world in one city, but me and you are from the north end of the city, so we know that. There are certain generations who will be denialism, would deny that fact. But it's certainly, the evidence is there. We've long had a, we've long been multicultural, really.
It's interesting as well where when you say it in these days and someone says, well, what about this? What about that? What about, people have to focus on something. If you write a book about something, then you're going to be focusing on that. That's how like consciousness works at a basic level. And I've done it myself,
Reflecting
commenting on
any.
it is. I've done it myself talking about like Gaza and the Ukraine because they're big border disputes. They get in the news a lot, and things like Sudan and other places, the Rohingya in Myanmar, like barely get mentioned in international news. And there's a lot of truth to it, but like. You'd never get onto the topic that you wanted to focus on or look at or discuss if you had to acknowledge everything else. Do you know what I mean? And people do have to
No, but
focus on things.
in the past, I think now through books like this, you take the Industrial Revolution, for example, you can talk about an invention, say the steam engine, James Watt, who moved to Cornwall to resource copper, and that was used as copper sheathing to make the ships get faster across across the Atlantic. And you can end up helping to produce these big like sugar bowls. To melt the sugar down, it's extract the from the sugar cane, etc. I haven't got the true like process, industrial process, but through that story, you've got the Industrial Revolution, you've got empire, and you've got slavery. When we were at school, or when we first started teaching, you just learn about the flying shuttle. Was it K? Well, there's no mention of where the cotton came from or who was picking the cotton. So that.
That was interesting
That,
because you did the Industrial Revolution and then you did slavery as
yeah,
another part of the curriculum. And
and
then
then
you
now
did
you do,
him,
and then you do Empire,
as another thing. And in many ways, that was the national thing. But in a lot of schools now, that black history is gone. And I think that's being represented in some of the stuff I'm hearing from kids these days. And I think another big thing is, it was you were almost sick to the back teeth of teaching Nazism. But I think a lot of curriculum now don't do Nazism in as much detail. And we're seeing a rise of populism and stuff. And I do think that there are connections between those things. It's interesting.
Well, with the onset of academisation, they've had more autonomy. They don't have to adhere to the national curriculum. But I'm still seeing a lot of Hitler and Henry
And in
by chapter.
fairness, the national curriculum, this one size fits all, it didn't really help. And you do need some flexibility. But at the same time, when Gove rewrote his curriculum in 2012, 2013, it was just like some private school dream world, elite dream world that that him and Boris would sit down and come up with. It was just ridiculous, wasn't it?
Well, Gove asked for the national story, and I think the history community just we basically ignored them. And I think curriculums are more diverse, more broad and balanced than ever, to be fair, because I think the history community collectively, kicked back against that, thankfully.
There was like a consultation with history
Yeah.
teachers, and there was a big pushback, and he did change it. So they got like
Yeah.
Clive of India off. Clive of India was meant to be
Yeah.
like the first
He
thing on
wants
their
them there. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
all that
Well, that's it,
stuff.
you see.
Yeah.
So many people in, yeah, sorry, Tim.
No, go on.
No, I was saying back to what we said before, many people in this nation, they only want to hear like the good that Britain's done
Yeah.
in its past.
Yeah.
And, like I said, they need to be, I think more people need to be a bit more grown up about it, but they need to be better informed. You see, people can only, believe what they read or what they see. And I think a lot of that is denied, isn't it? It's censored.
Yeah. Well, I think this book's going to be a great contribution to school life, also to wider
Hopefully.
academic and public history. No worries, but thanks for
Yeah.
coming on. I think we touched on a lot there. We could think about, looking at a few other things in the future if you want, focusing on a particular topic. But that
Well,
was great, and I would recommend people go out and get this book. I'll share details when the time comes.
thank you for having me, Tim. It's always good to talk
Yeah, no
to my
worries.
old friend. Thanks a lot.
Cheers, mate.